Charles Mingus was known as jazz's angry man. His wife was a journalist from the Midwest who seemed to have nothing in common with Mingus. But Sue Graham Mingus says her marriage to the legendary bassist, composer, and bandleader ultimately made sense. Sue Mingus writes about their relationship in the book Tonight at Noon, a love story. She says she'll never forget the first time she saw Mingus.
Jazz clubs used to stay open until 4 in the morning, and Charles said he might then go uptown to Birdland, a famous jazz club at the time, stand on the sidewalk, talk to another musician, maybe Oscar Pettiford, a bass player, and then they might go further uptown to Harlem to one of the clubs and jam until 10 or 11 in the morning, so that by the time he got home, it was noontime, which was his midnight. So that was the genesis of that idea of Tonight at Noon. It meant additionally something to me because when Charles died, he wanted his ashes scattered in the Ganges River. So I went to India, and after the ceremony, I was walking up the beach, and I thought about that title. Charles believed in reincarnation, which was part of the reason why he wanted this ceremony. He believed in the Hindu religion and all the prophets that are included in that religion from all the other religions. And I thought about how Tonight at Noon could also mean night into day and death into life, which was the notion of reincarnation.
How did you meet him?
It was a late night jazz club after midnight on a Saturday night, packed, loud and noisy. And I noticed this figure sitting at this table all alone, focused on this tremendous beef bone that he was eating, absolutely meditating almost on this plate before him, like a chakra of a holy man. And I was already drawn. There was something, you know, you look back and you try to explain this. There was immediately something familiar to me about this person. I didn't know it was Charles Mingus. I didn't know it was the person that we had come to hear in the jazz club. My friend pointed him out to me subsequently. But I already felt a connection. And I said, you know, it's almost like a photograph that was developed too soon, you know, that showed the far off events that would happen years later. But there was some kind of mystical connection, unexplainable. Yeah. When I first saw him that night.
What's interesting in a lot of ways is that over the next few years, you had a very tempestuous relationship.
Very tempestuous. it was worlds in collision, definitely.
And Charles Mingus was not an easy character for anybody to be around.
No, he was not an easy character, but part of that was he was an enormously gifted artist in a society that did not recognize his gifts, that was a hostile society because of the color of his skin. And he developed his various defense mechanisms. You know, we all approach a hostile world in one way or another. Duke Ellington used to say, "I love you madly," with his great sense of irony and also legitimate love. Maybe Charles would raise a fist, you know. But whatever, he found a way of dancing around the opposition. But at home, I mean, the real Charles, and you hear it in his music, because his music expresses all the sides of his personality. I don't think there's any more personal music in American music. It's very personal, it's very varied, and it has everything from the anger and the love and the intimidation and the spirituality and so forth. The real Charles was the man sitting at the piano day after day composing. He used to say he took credit for his great virtuosity on the bass violin, but he always said the melody came from God. And he used to say that when he went to the piano, he found the music waiting for him on the keys. When I met Charles, we were working together. I certainly had no idea that I was going to end up many years down the pike marrying him. I mean, we met in 64. We got married, I think, in 74.
The way you described the wedding, I can understand you're not being entirely sure. You said that when the two of you got married, the judge had to tell you to put your newspaper down.
Well, that's because we had already been living together for 3 or 4 years. We were married originally in this wonderful ceremony, only a couple of years after we met, by Allen Ginsberg. We were at a prenuptial party at Peggy Hitchcock's house in Manhattan. And in the course of it, we ran into Allen Ginsberg on one of the floors of this brownstone, and Charles simply said, "Marry us." And Allen Ginsberg, who never said no to anything, drew up two spindly chairs, had us sit down, and he used to carry these bells in his hand. And he did this Hindu chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Hare, Rama Rama, for about 2 hours, and married us. And when we came out of this rather kind of hypnotic trance, we were surrounded by people in the wedding party who had wrapped up presents from around the house and were uncorking bottles of champagne, and it was a real celebration. The more formal, traditional, I mean, not traditional, but the justice of the peace state wedding that we did years later did not have any of the resonance of that first wedding. We actually had planned a big ceremony out in the country. I had a place up in Woodstock. We'd hired a bus. At the time, I was publishing a newspaper, and we were going to bring everybody up to the country. And we had it all planned, the dresses, the banquets. And Charles came back from a European tour with a bad back, went right into the hospital for 3 weeks. And so we canceled that formal wedding, but we already had all our papers. So a few weeks later, on our way to the airport, Charles was going on a European tour. We hopped into City Hall and just got married, you know, standing in a long line with 50 other couples. And it was about as emotional, I said, as waiting at a bus stop. And in fact, I had this newspaper under my arm, and the judge kind of snapped at me and said, "Madam, would you put your paper down? You're getting married," you know. But, I mean, it did not carry all the intensity and formality, you know, that a normal wedding would carry.
You know, it's funny about listening to these stories that you tell is that it sounds in many ways sort of idyllic. You found the man who should be with you for the rest of your life. He found the woman who should be with him. But he was a man whom everyone describes as being so extraordinarily full of energy, so tempestuous, if you will, ranting on about things. That sounds like an entirely different person.
Well, that was one side of the coin, you know. What gets attention are the flashy, bombastic, aggressive, loud scenes. That's what got the write-ups. The press loved Charles. In those days, it was called a happening. He was an event on stage. Not only did he play this extraordinary music, but he was a larger-than-life personality who felt, oddly enough, that his music should be listened to, that people should not talk during a solo, that the bartender should not ring up the cash register in a magical, lyrical moment. And he used to say, "Isaac Stern doesn't have to put up with this." He felt his music, even though it was played in noisy jazz clubs, should be treated like serious American music. And he would berate the audience. I mean, he knew who he was, he knew what he wanted, and nothing stopped him from expressing that.
I was thinking there was a thing in your book about this one of his sons, the one they called Charles III,
right,
coming to visit with a painting that he had.
Yes.
Now, you'd expect a father to say, "Oh, what a gorgeous piece of work." That wouldn't be Mingus, though, would it?
No, because Charles always put truth before tactfulness, before everything. He told things the way he saw them, without embellishment, without apology. His son showed him a painting, and he said, "Go paint an apple." And he said, "You can't improvise on nothing." In other words, you have to begin with something. Charles was a great historian. I mean, he felt that you had to dominate everything that went before you. And then once you had absorbed that, you went on and you played yourself. He once said, without really a sense of arrogance at all, "How could I not be greater than Bach?" And what he meant by that, he said, he laid it all out for me. Meaning that if you were a serious musician, and this is true in any discipline, I mean, I don't know how many artists are as profoundly serious about their art as this comment, but he felt that that you should learn everything that went before you, Stravinsky, Bartok, Beethoven, Duke Ellington, whatever it was, and absorb that history, and that should be part of your music. And then you go on and you play yourself.
What was it like for you to watch him on stage?
What was wonderful about Charles is that he was always surprising. Nothing was predictable. Charles did a piano album. It was called Mingus Plays Piano. And the first piece he played on the piano was called Myself When I Am Real. It was maybe 6 or 7 minutes. Now, when Alvin Ailey, the dancer, was choreographing for the Robert Joffrey Ballet Company, he set this piece, he made a dance of this Myself When I'm Real, and it was scored for 60-piece orchestra. Those classical musicians could not believe that this little 6-minute piece had been improvised into the piano. Charles called it a spontaneous composition because it was so structured. And these movements were so logical and fit into this whole shape. But so I'm saying Charles had that kind of genius mind and shape and structure so that he could afford in all his life to be completely spontaneous and unexpected and surprising. And there was always a foundation. It was connected to a reason and a purpose.
He had all of this knowledge inside him. He had all this energy inside him. And then the story can't be completed without talking about how the outer shell was taken away from him. Lou Gehrig's disease robs you of your body, but not necessarily of your soul. And I gather it didn't take him that way.
Well, no, that's why I wanted to write about Charles in the course of this period. For a man as physical as he was, to be paralyzed completely in a wheelchair where a ray of sunlight or a buzzing fly, I mean, you need help because there's nothing you can do. And he had such grace and heroism in the face of this. I think I would have lasted 24 hours in a situation like this, absolutely paralyzed. Your mind, of course, continues a million miles an hour. I mean, you're completely aware. But he ran our household. He ordered. We drove through Mexico. We went to the tops of mountains and the bottoms of valleys. We traveled all night long because when we put the wheelchair in a special van, and it was like a cradle. It gave Charles some sort of peace, this rocking back and forth in the wheelchair. And we traveled all through Mexico all night long. And then we'd come back to this home that we had rented in Cuernavaca and begin all over again. But he was full of imagination. He kept us all on our toes. His appetites never weakened. 2 days before he died, we were scurrying through the town of Cuernavaca looking for these pineapple ice cream pops, which he had to have. I mean, his appetites never abated. It was a great learning, a very moving and profound experience for me to see someone absolutely in this trial by fire rise to the occasion and live up to everything he ever shouted, any value ever shouted from the stage. He certainly lived up to in those last months in Mexico.
Sue Graham Mingus is the widow of the jazz legend Charles Mingus. Her book is Tonight at Noon.